citizens over the age of 65. He alluded to this tradition in the measure's very title, calling it the Old Age Home Guard of the United States Army. Beginning in the 1880s, reformers like Jane Addams and Florence Kelly in Chicago had been leading a fight for legislative labor reforms for women, including minimum wage and maximum hour laws and the abolition of child labor. Their first success came in 1883, when Illinois passed a law for an 8-hour workday for women. And yet each of these progressive reforms, from social insurance to protective legislation, faced a legal obstacle. Their critics called them unconstitutional. The Illinois Supreme Court struck down the 8-hour workday law, and in a particularly remarkable set of decisions issued at a time when courts were coming not only to support government intervention, but also to be tools of reform, the U.S. Supreme Court overruled much progressive labor legislation. The most important of these decisions came in 1905. In a 5-4 decision in Lochner versus New York, the Supreme Court voided a state law establishing that bakers could work no longer than 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, on the ground that the law violated a business owner's liberty of contract, the freedom to forge agreements with his workers, something the court's majority said was protected under the 14th Amendment. The laissez-faire conservatism of the court was informed, in part, by social Darwinism, which suggested that the parties in disputes should be left to battle it out, and if one side had an advantage, even so great an advantage as a business owner had over his employees, then it should win. In a dissenting opinion in Lochner, Oliver Wendell Holmes accused the court of violating the will of the people. "This case is decided upon an economic theory which a large part of the country does not entertain," he began. The court, he said, had also wildly overreached its authority and had carried social Darwinism into the Constitution. "A constitution is not intended to body a particular economic theory," Holmes wrote. "The 14th Amendment does not enact Mr. Herbert Spencer's social statics." The Lochner decision intensified the debate about judicial review that had begun with Marbury versus Madison in 1803. Critics charged conservatives with putting courts into politics and compelling judges to become politicians. Meanwhile, progressives painted themselves as advocates of the people and, continuing a long tradition in American politics, insisted that their political position represented the people's view of the Constitution as against that of a corrupt judiciary. Roosevelt would eventually pledge to institute judicial recall, making it possible for justices to be essentially impeached, insisting, "The people themselves must be the ultimate makers of their Constitution." From either political vantage, the heart of the struggle concerned the constitutionality of the provisions of a welfare state. Britain, which does not have a written constitution, established the foundations for what would become a comprehensive welfare state, complete with health insurance and old age pensions, at the very time that the United States was failing to do the same. Wilson pointed out that the Constitution, written before mass industrialization, couldn't be expected to have anticipated it and couldn't solve the problems industrialization had created unless the Constitution were treated like a living thing that, like an organism, evolved. Critics further to the left argued that the courts had become an instrument of business interests. Unions, in fact, often failed to support labor reform legislation, partly because they expected it to be struck down by the courts as unconstitutional, and partly because they wanted unions to provide benefits to their members, which would be an argument for organizing. If the government provided these social benefits, workers wouldn't need unions, or so some union leaders feared. Meanwhile, conservatives insisted that the courts were right to protect the interests of business, and that either market forces would find a way to care for the sick, injured, or old workers, or, for social Darwinists, that the weakest, who were not meant to thrive, would wither and die. For all of these reasons, American progressives campaigning for universal health insurance enjoyed far less success than their counterparts in Britain. In 1912, 1 year after Parliament passed a National Insurance Act, the American Association for Labor Legislation formed a committee on social insurance, the brainchild of Isaac M. Rubinow, a Russian-born doctor turned policymaker, who would publish in 1913 the landmark study Social Insurance. Rubinow had hoped that sickness insurance would eradicate poverty. By 1915, his committee had drafted a bill providing for universal medical coverage. "No other social movement in modern economic development is so pregnant with benefit to the public," wrote the editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association. "At present, the United States has the unenviable distinction of being the only great industrial nation without compulsory health insurance," the Yale economist Irving Fisher pointed out in 1916. It would maintain that unenviable distinction for a century. Congress debated Rubinow's bill, which was also put forward in 16 states. Germany showed the way in 1883, Fischer liked to say, pointing to the policy's origins. Her wonderful progress since that time, her comparative freedom from poverty and the physical preparedness of her soldiery, are presumably due, in considerable measure, to health insurance. But after the United States declared war on Germany in 1917, critics described national health insurance as made in Germany and likely to result in the Prussianization of America. In California, the legislature passed a constitutional amendment providing for universal health insurance. But when it was put on the ballot for ratification, a federation of insurance companies took out an ad in the San Francisco Chronicle warning that it would spell social ruin in the United States. Every voter in the state received in the mail a pamphlet with a picture of the Kaiser and the words, "Born in Germany, do you want it in California?" The measure was defeated. Opponents called universal health insurance un-American, unsafe, uneconomic, unscientific, unfair, and unscrupulous. The fastest way through the constitutional thicket, it turned out, was to argue for welfare not for men, but for women and children. By 1900, nearly one in five manufacturing jobs in the United States was held by a woman. Women and children couldn't vote, and seeking labor reform and social insurance, they sought from the state not rights, but protections. Mothers made claims on the state in the same terms as did veterans, a claim of services rendered. And even women who had not yet had children could be understood for these purposes as potential mothers. To that end, much of the early lobbying for protective legislation for women and children was done by the National Congress of Mothers, later known as the Parent-Teacher Association, or the PTA. Founded in 1897 by Phoebe Apperson Hearst, the mother of the newspaper tycoon, and Alice McClellan Burney, the wife of a Washington, D.C. lawyer, the National Congress of Mothers aimed to serve as a female auxiliary to the national legislature. "This is the one body that I put even ahead of the veterans of the Civil War," Theodore Roosevelt declared in 1908, "because when all is said and done, it is the mother and the mother only who is a better citizen even than the soldier who fights for his country." Women were also consumers. In 1899, Florence Kelly, the daughter of an abolitionist who had helped found the Republican Party, became the first general secretary of the National Consumers League. Her motto, "Investigate, record, agitate." Kelly, born in Philadelphia in 1856, had studied at Cornell and in Zurich, where she became a socialist. In 1885, she translated the work of Friedrich Engels. In the 1890s, while working at Jane Addams's Hull House in Chicago, she earned a law degree at Northwestern. Eyeing the court's decision in Lochner and understanding that the courts treated women differently than men, Kelly wondered whether maximum hour legislation might have a better chance of success in the courts if the test case were a law aimed specifically at female workers. Already, state courts had made rulings in that direction. In 1902, the Nebraska Supreme Court decreed that the state must be accorded the right to guard and protect women as a class against such condition, and the law in question, to that extent, conserves the public wealth and welfare. For women who are not written into the Constitution, winning constitutional arguments has always required constitutional patching, cutting and pasting, scissors and a pot of glue. In an era in which the court plainly favored arguments that stopped short of actual equality, Plessy v. Ferguson, after all, had instituted the doctrine of separate but equal rather than provide equal protection to African Americans, Kelly tried arguing that women, physically weaker than men, deserved special protection. In 1906, the Oregon Supreme Court upheld a female 10-hour law that had been challenged by a laundryman named Kurt Muller. Muller appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Kelly arranged for a lawyer named Louis Brandeis to argue the case for Oregon. Brandeis, known as the People's Attorney, was born in Kentucky in 1856, graduated from Harvard Law School in 1876, and married Alice Goldmark in 1891. Much of the legwork for the Muller case was done by the indefatigable reformer Josephine Goldmark, who worked for Kelly and was also Brandeis's sister-in-law. Goldmark compiled the findings of hundreds of reports and studies by physicians, municipal health boards, public health departments, medical societies, factory inspectors, and bureaus of labor, demonstrating the harm done to women by working long hours. She presented Brandeis with a 113-page amicus brief that Brandeis submitted to the Supreme Court in 1908 in Muller v. Oregon. "The decision in this case will in effect determine the constitutionality of nearly all the statutes in force in the United States limiting the hours of labor of adult women," Brandeis explained, arguing that overwork is more disastrous to the health of women than of men and entails upon them more lasting injury. the Oregon law was upheld. Mueller versus Oregon established the constitutionality of labor laws for women, the legitimacy of sex discrimination in employment, and the place of social science research in the decisions of the courts. The Brandeis brief, as it came to be called, essentially made muckraking admissible as evidence. Where the court in Plessy versus Ferguson had scorned any discussion of the facts of racial inequality, citing the prevailing force of tradition, Mueller versus Oregon established the conditions that would allow for the presentation of social science evidence in the case that would overrule racial segregation in Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka in 1954. History discloses the fact that woman has always been dependent upon man, Brandeis argued in Mueller versus Oregon. Differentiated by these matters from the other sex, she is properly placed in a class by herself, and legislation designed for her protection may be sustained even when that legislation is not necessary for men and could not be sustained. Kelly used this difference as a wedge. Between 1911 and 1920, laws providing relief for women in the form of mothers' and widows' pensions passed in 40 states. Between 1909 and 1917, maximum hour laws for women passed in 39 states. And between 1912 and 1923, minimum wage laws for women passed in 15 states. But Kelly and female protectionists had made a Faustian bargain. These laws rested on the idea that women were dependent not only on men, but on the state. If women were ever to achieve equal rights, this sizable body of legislation designed to protect women would stand in their way. Mueller versus Oregon set the brilliant Louis Brandeis in a new direction. He became interested in the new field of efficiency as a means of addressing the problems of relations between labor and business. Brandeis became convinced that efficiency is the hope of democracy. The efficiency movement began when Bethlehem Steelworks in Pennsylvania hired a mechanical engineer from Philadelphia named Frederick Winslow Taylor to speed production, which Taylor proposed to do with a system he called task management, or later, the gospel of efficiency. As Taylor explained in 1911 in his best-selling book, The Principles of Scientific Management, he timed the Bethlehem steelworkers with a stopwatch, identified the fastest worker, a first-class man, from among 10 powerful Hungarians, and calculated the fastest rate at which a unit of work could be done. Thenceforth, all workers were required to work at that rate or lose their jobs. Taylor, though, had made up most of his figures. After charging Bethlehem Steel 2.5 times what he could possibly have saved their company from labor costs, he, too, was fired. Nevertheless, Taylorism endured. Efficiency promised to speed production, lower the cost of goods, and improve the lives of workers, goals it often achieved. It was also a way to minimize strikes and to manage labor, particularly immigrant labor. Before 1896, European immigrants to the United States had chiefly come from Northern and Western Europe, and especially from Germany and Ireland. After 1896, most came from the South and the East, and especially from Italy and Hungary. Slavs, Jews, and Italians, lumped together as the new immigrants, also came in far greater numbers than Europeans had ever come before, sometimes more than 1 million a year. The number of Europeans who arrived in the 12 years between 1902 and 1914 alone totaled more than the number of Europeans who arrived in the 4 decades between 1820 and 1860. No one implemented the regime of efficiency better than Henry Ford. In 1903, Ford, the 40-year-old son of Michigan farmers, opened a motor car company in Detroit, where workers, timed by a clock, put together parts on an assembly line. By 1914, Ford's plant was manufacturing nearly 250,000 cars every year, cars that cost 1/4 of what he'd sold them for a decade earlier. Before the automobile, only businesses owned large machines. As Walter Chrysler explained, "We were making the first machine of considerable size in the history of the world for which every human being was a potential customer." If the railroad served as the symbol of progress in the 19th century, the automobile served as its symbol in the 20th, a consumer commodity that celebrated individualism and choice, announced Ford. "Machinery is the new messiah." Efficiency reached into family life with the founding of home economics. Ford exerted particular control over the home lives of his largely immigrant workers by way of a sociological department. "Employees should use plenty of soap and water in the home and upon their children bathing frequently," one pamphlet recommended. "Nothing makes for right living and health so much as cleanliness. Notice that the most advanced people are the cleanest." Ford also founded an English school to Americanize his immigrant workers, using the same methods of assembly that he used in his plant. There is a course in industry and efficiency, a course in thrift and economy, a course in domestic relations, one in community relations, and one in industrial relations, Ford's English school announced. This is the human product we seek to turn out. And as we adapt the machinery in the shop to turning out the kind of automobile we have in mind, so we have constructed our educational system with a view to producing the human product we have in mind. Brandeis came to believe that Taylorism could solve the problem of mass industrialism and mass democracy. While preparing to appear before the Interstate Commerce Committee on railroad freight cars, Brandeis had called a meeting of efficiency experts. In the Commerce Committee hearings, he argued that instead of raising their freight rates, railroads ought to do their work more efficiently. With scientific management, Brandeis said, railroad companies could save $1 million a day. He won the argument, but the people who worked on railroads and in factories soon began attempting to convince him that those savings came at their expense. The next year, when Brandeis gave a speech about efficiency to a labor union, one woman shouted at him, "You can call it scientific management if you want to, but I call it scientific driving." Some members of Congress suspected the same. In 1912, William B. Wilson, who'd gone down into the coal pits at the age of 9 and joined the union at 11, chaired a House special committee to investigate Taylor and other systems of shop management. When Taylor, called to testify, talked about first-class men, Wilson inquired about workers who weren't first-class men, men whom Taylor had described as dumb as dray horses. "Scientific management has no place for such men?" Wilson asked. "Scientific management has no place for a bird that can sing and won't sing," answered Taylor. "We are not dealing with horses nor singing birds," Wilson told Taylor. "We are dealing with men who are a part of society and for whose benefit society is organized." Were men animals? Were men machines? Was machinery a messiah and efficiency a gospel? With businesses driving workers to toil at breakneck speed, a growing number of Americans were drawn to socialism, especially since neither of the two major parties had any good answer to William B. Wilson's anguished exchange with Frederick Winslow Taylor. One union man in Schenectady said, "People got mighty sick of voting for Republicans and Democrats when it was a heads-I-win-tails-you-lose proposition." In the presidential election of 1908, more than 400,000 people voted for the Socialist Party candidate, Eugene Debs. In 1911, socialists were elected as mayors of 18 cities and towns, and more than 1,000 socialists held offices in 30 states. Heads or tails was how the Democrats and Republicans looked to a lot of people in 1912, too, when Debs ran again. Woodrow Wilson won the Democratic nomination, and Theodore Roosevelt hoped to win the Republican one. Wilson believed that it was the obligation of the federal government to regulate the economy to protect ordinary Americans from the consequences of great industrial and social processes which they cannot alter, control, or singly cope with. This scarcely distinguished him from Roosevelt. "The object of our government is the welfare of the people," Roosevelt said. As Roosevelt put it, "Wilson is merely a less virile me." The election of 1912 amounted to a referendum on progressivism, much influenced by the political agitation of women. With a suddenness and force that have left observers gasping, women have injected themselves into the national campaign this year in a manner never before dreamed of in American politics, the New York Herald reported, though only reporters who hadn't been paying attention saw anything sudden about it. Having fought for their rights formally since 1848, women had achieved the right to vote in 8 states: Colorado, 1893, Idaho, 1896, Utah, 1896, Washington, 1910, California, 1911, Arizona, 1912, Kansas, 1912, and Oregon, 1912. They'd also begun fighting for a great deal more than suffrage. The word feminism entered English in the 1910s as a generation of independent women, many of them college-educated, new women, they were called, fought for equal education, equal opportunity, equal citizenship, and equal rights, and not least for birth control, a term coined by a nurse named Margaret Sanger when she launched the first feminist newspaper, The Woman Rebel, in 1914. In 1912 and again in 1916, suffragists marched on the streets of cities across the country, organized on the campuses of women's colleges, and staged hunger strikes. They waged old-style political campaigns with buttons and banners. They flew in balloons. They decorated elephants and donkeys. Women who'd gone to prison for picketing took a train across the country as a prison special, wearing their prison uniforms. They dressed as statues. They wore red, white, and blue. They marched in chains. They waged a moral crusade in the style of abolitionists, but on the streets, in the style of Jacksonian Democrats. Roosevelt, in an extraordinary campaign for direct democracy and social justice, hoped to wrest the Republican nomination from Taft, partly by appealing to female voters, but mainly by availing himself of another progressive reform, the direct primary. Progressive reformers, viewing nominating conventions as corrupt, had fought instead for state primaries, in which voters could choose their own presidential candidates. The first primary was held in 1899. The reform, led by Wisconsin's Robert La Follette, gained strength in 1905. Let the people rule became Roosevelt's 1912 slogan. The great fundamental issue now before the Republican Party and before our people can be stated briefly, he said. It is, are the American people fit to govern themselves, to rule themselves, to control themselves? I believe they are. My opponents do not. 13 states held primaries. All were non-binding. Roosevelt won 9. As with the secret ballot, primaries were part progressive reform, part Jim Crow. Roosevelt needed to win them because, at the Republican National Convention, he had no real chance of winning black delegates. Because the Republican Party had virtually no white support in the South, the only Southern delegates were black delegates, men who had been appointed to party offices by the Taft administration. Roosevelt tried in vain to wrest them from their support for the president. "I like the Negro race," he said in a speech at an AME church the day before the convention. But the next day, the New York Times produced affidavits proving that Roosevelt's campaign wasn't so much trying to court black delegates as to bribe them. After Roosevelt lost the nomination to Taft, he formed the Progressive Party, whose convention refused to seat black delegates. "This is strictly a white man's party," said one of Roosevelt's supporters, a leader of the so-called Lily Whites. But the Progressive Party was not, in fact, strictly a white man's party. It was also a white woman's party. Roosevelt's new party adopted a suffrage plank, and Roosevelt promised to appoint Jane Addams to his cabinet. Addams gave the second nominating speech at the convention, after which she marched across the hall carrying a Votes for Women flag. Returning to her office, she found a telegram from a black newspaper editor that read, "Woman's suffrage will be stained with Negro blood unless women refuse all alliance with Roosevelt." Roosevelt's 1912 campaign marked a turn in American politics by venturing the novel idea that a national presidential administration answers national public opinion without the mediation either of parties or of representatives in Congress. The candidate, Roosevelt suggested, is more important than the party. Roosevelt also used film clips and mass advertising in a way that no candidate had done before, gathering a national following through the tools of modern publicity and bypassing the party system by reaching voters directly. That he failed to win the presidency did not diminish the influence of this new conception of the nature of American political and constitutional arrangements. In the end, Roosevelt won 27% of the popular vote, more than any third party candidate either before or since. But having drawn most of those votes from Taft, Roosevelt's campaign allowed Wilson to gain the White House, the first Southern president elected since the Civil War. Democrats controlled both houses of Congress, too, for the first time in decades. "Men's hearts wait upon us," Wilson said in his inaugural address, before the largest crowd ever gathered at an inauguration. Wilson, having earned the endorsement of William James Bryan, rewarded him by naming him his Secretary of State. At the inauguration, Bryan sat right behind Wilson, a measure of the distance populism had traveled from the prairies of Kansas and Nebraska. Few presidents have achieved so much so quickly as did Wilson, who delivered on an extraordinary number of his promised progressive reforms. Learning from Roosevelt's good relationship with the press while in the White House, Wilson, in his first month, invited more than 100 reporters to his office, fielded questions, and announced that he intended to do this regularly. In his first 10 months alone, he held 60 press conferences. The author of Congressional Government also kept the 63rd Congress in session for 18 months straight, longer than Congress had ever met before. Congress obliged by lowering the tariff, reforming banking and currency laws, abolishing child labor, and passing a new antitrust act, the first 8-hour workday legislation, and the first federal aid to farmers. Among Wilson's hardest fights was his nomination of Louis Brandeis to the Supreme Court, one of the most controversial in the court's history. Not because Brandeis was the first Jew appointed to the court, though that was controversial in some quarters, but because Brandeis was a dogged opponent of plutocrats. Beyond the cases he'd argued, Brandeis had become something of a muckraker, publishing an indictment of the plutocracy, other people's money and how the bankers use it, parts of which sounded as though they could have been written by the likes of Mary E. Leese. "The power and the growth of the power of our financial oligarchs comes from wielding the savings and quick capital of others," he wrote. "The fetters which bind people are forged from the people's own gold." He pointed out that J.P. Morgan and the First National and National City Bank together held 341 directorships and 112 corporations having aggregate resources or capitalization of $22,245,000,000, a sum that is more than three times the assessed value of all the real estate in the city of New York and more than the assessed value of all the property in the 22 states north and south lying west of the Mississippi River. During the Judiciary Committee debates over Brandeis's nomination, one senator remarked, "The real crime of which this man is guilty is that he's exposed the iniquities of men in high places in our financial system." Wilson fought hard for Brandeis and won, and Brandeis's presence on the bench made all the difference to the endurance of progressive reform. But like other progressives, Wilson not only failed to offer any remedy for racial inequality, he endorsed it. On the 50th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg, he spoke on the battlefield at a reunion of more than 50,000 Union and Confederate veterans. "A reunion for whom?" asked the Washington Bee. Black soldiers were not included. It was instead a reunion between whites in the North and in the South, an agreement to remember the Civil War as a war over states' rights and to forget the cause of slavery. "We have found one another again as brothers and comrades in arms, enemies no longer, generous friends, rather, our battles long past, the quarrel forgotten," Wilson told the veterans at Gettysburg. A week later, his administration mandated separate bathrooms for blacks and whites working in the Treasury Department. Soon, he segregated the entire civil service, bringing Jim Crow to the nation's capital. "There may have been other presidents who held the same sort of sentiments," wrote the NAACP's James Weldon Johnson. "But Mr. Wilson bears the discreditable distinction of being the first president of the United States since emancipation who openly condoned and vindicated prejudice against the Negro." Jim Crow thrived because after the end of Reconstruction in 1877, reformers who had earlier fought for the cause of civil rights abandoned it for the sake of forging a reunion between the states and the federal government and between the North and the South. This wasn't Wilson's doing. This was the work of his generation, the work of the generation that came before him and the work of the generation that would follow him, an abdication of struggle, an abandonment of justice. 2. War broke out in Europe in July of 1914, war on a scale that had never been seen before, a war run by efficiency experts and waged with factory-made munitions, a war without limit or mercy. Machines slaughtered the masses. Europe fell to its knees. The United States rose to its feet. The Great War brought the United States into the world. It marked the end of Europe's reign as the center of the Western world. That place, after the war, was held by the United States. At the start, Americans only watched, numb, shocked to discover that the 19th century's great steam-powered ship of progress had carried its all-too-trusting passengers to the edge of an abyss. "The tide that bore us along was then, all the whole while, moving to this as its Grand Niagara," wrote Henry James. The scale of death in the American Civil War, so staggering at the time, 750,000 dead in 4 years of fighting, looked by comparison minuscule. Within the first 8 weeks of the war alone, nearly 400,000 Germans were killed, wounded, sick, or missing. In 1916, over a matter of mere months, there were 800,000 military casualties in Verdun and 1.1 million at the Somme. But civilians were slaughtered, too. The Ottoman government massacred as many as 1.5 million Armenians. For the first time, war was waged by airplane, bombs dropped from a great height as if by the gods themselves. Cathedrals were shelled, libraries bombed, hospitals blasted. Before the war was over, nearly 40 million people had been killed and another 20 million wounded. What sane person could believe in progress in an age of mass slaughter? The Great War steered the course of American politics like a gale force wind. The specter of slaughter undercut progressivism, suppressed socialism, and produced anti-colonialism. And by illustrating the enduring wickedness of humanity and appearing to fulfill prophecies of apocalypse as punishment for the moral travesty of modernism, the war fueled fundamentalism. Fundamentalists' descent from Protestantism had to do with the idea of truth, a descent that would greatly influence the history of a nation whose creed rests on a very particular set of truths. Fundamentalism began with the rejection of Darwinism. Some of fundamentalism's best-remembered preachers are Southerners who moved west, like the Alabama-born Texas Baptist J. Frank Norris, 6'1" and hard as oak. I was born in the dark of the moon in the dog fennel season just after a black cat had jumped upon a black coffin, Norris liked to say. Ordained in 1897, Norris went on to rail against that hell-born, Bible-destroying, deity-of-Christ-denying German rationalism known as evolution. But fundamentalism began among educated northern ministers. Influenced by Scottish common-sense philosophers, early fundamentalists like the Princeton Theological Seminary's Charles Hodge maintained that the object of theology was to establish the facts and principles of the Bible. Darwinism, Hodge thought, would lead to atheism. He then declared the Bible free from all error, a position that his son, A.A. Hodge, also a professor at Princeton, carried further. The younger Hodge insisted that it was the originals of the scriptures that were free from error, not the copies. The originals do not survive. This distinction usually went unnoticed by his followers. By insisting on the literal truth of the Bible, fundamentalists dared liberal theologians and social gospelers into a fight, especially after the publication, beginning in 1910, of a 12-volume series of pamphlets called The Fundamentals, A Testimony to the Truth. The purpose of a church is to convert people to Christ by teaching the actual literal gospel, fundamentalists insisted, not by preaching good works and social justice. Some people are trying to make a religion out of social service with Jesus Christ left out, the revivalist and ex-baseball player Billy Sunday complained in 1912. We've had enough of this godless social service nonsense. William Jennings Bryan, Mr. Fundamentalist, was not actually a fundamentalist. For one, he believed in the social gospel. For another, he does not appear ever to have owned a copy of The Fundamentals. And as a man unconcerned with theological matters, he hardly ever bothered defending the literal truth of the Bible. Christ went about doing good, was the sum of Bryan's theology. Bryan was confused for a fundamentalist because he led a drive to prohibit the teaching of evolution in the nation's schools. But Bryan saw the campaign against evolution as another arm of his decades-long campaign against the plutocracy, telling a cartoonist, "You should represent me as using a double-barreled shotgun, fixing one barrel at the elephant as he tries to enter the treasury, and another at Darwinism, the monkey, as he tries to enter the schoolroom." Bryan's difficulty was that he saw no difference between Darwinism and social Darwinism. But it was social Darwinism that he attacked, the brutality of a political philosophy that seemed to believe in nothing more than the survival of the fittest, or what Bryan called the law of hate, the merciless law by which the strong crowd out and kill the weak. How could a war without mercy not set this movement aflame? Germany was the enemy, the same Germany whose model of education had secularized American colleges and universities, which were now teaching eugenics, sometimes known as the science of human betterment, calling for the elimination from the human race of people deemed unfit to reproduce on the basis of their intelligence, criminality, or background. Bryan wasn't battling a chimera. American universities were indeed breeding eugenicists. Zoologist Charles Davenport was a professor at Harvard when he wrote Statistical Methods with Special Reference to Biological Variation. In 1910, in Eugenics, he defined the field as the science of human improvement by better breeding. Biologist David Jordan was president of Stanford in 1906 when he headed a committee for the American Breeders Association, an organization founded by Davenport, whose purpose was to investigate and report on heredity in the human race and to document the value of superior blood and the menace to society of the inferior. Nor was this academic research without consequence. Beginning in 1907, with Indiana, two-thirds of American states passed forced sterilization laws. In 1916, Madison Grant, the president of the Museum of Natural History in New York, who had degrees from Yale and Columbia, published The Passing of the Great Race, or The Racial Basis of European History, a hereditary history of the human race, in which he identified Northern Europeans, the blue-eyed, fair-haired peoples of the north of Europe that he called the Nordic race, as genetically superior to Southern Europeans, the dark-haired, dark-eyed people he called the Alpine race, and lamented the presence of swarms of Jews and half-breeds. In the United States, Grant argued, the Alpine race was overwhelming the Nordic race, threatening the American Republic, since democracy is fatal to progress when two races of unequal value live side by side. Progressives mocked fundamentalists as anti-intellectual, but fundamentalists were, of course, making an intellectual argument, if one that not many academics wanted to hear. In 1917, William B. Riley, who, like J. Frank Norris, had trained at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, published a book called The Menace of Modernism, whose attack on evolution included a broader attack on the predominance in public debate of liberal faculty housed at secular universities and the silencing of conservative opinion. Conservatives, Riley pointed out, have about as good a chance to be heard in a Turkish harem as to be invited to speak within the precincts of a modern state university. In 1919, Riley helped bring 6,000 people to the first meeting of the World's Christian Fundamentals Association. The horror of the war fueled the movement, convincing many evangelicals that the growing secularization of society was responsible for this grotesque parade of inhumanity, mass slaughter. The new theology has led Germany into barbarism, one fundamentalist argued in 1918, and it will lead any nation into the same demoralization. Even as Americans reeled from the slaughter in Europe, the United States edged toward war. There'll be no war while I'm Secretary of State, Bryan had pledged when he joined the Woodrow Wilson administration. But in 1915, Bryan resigned, unable to halt the drift toward American entry into the war. Peace protests, mainly led by women, had begun just weeks after war broke out. At a women's peace parade in New York in the summer of 1914, 15,000 women marched, dressed in mourning. Meanwhile, women were also marching for suffrage, the two causes twining together, on the theory that if women could vote, they'd vote against sending their sons and husbands to war. In 1916, Wilson campaigned for re-election by pledging to keep the United States out of the war. The GOP nominated former Supreme Court Justice Charles Evans Hughes, who took the opposing position. A vote for Hughes is a vote for war, explained a senator from Oklahoma. A vote for Wilson is a vote for peace. If my re-election as president depends upon my getting into war, I don't want to be president, Wilson said privately. He kept us out of war, became his campaign slogan. And when Theodore Roosevelt called that an ignoble shirking of responsibility, Wilson countered, I am an American, but I do not believe that any of us loves a blustering nationality. Wilson had withheld support from female suffrage, but women who could vote tended to favor peace. Suffragist Alice Paul decided that women, spurned by both parties, needed a party of their own. The National Woman's Party proceeded to parade through the streets of Denver with a donkey named Woodrow, who carried a sign that read, It means freedom for women to vote against the party this donkey represents. Paul did not prevail. In the end, it was women voters who, by rallying behind the peace movement, gained Wilson a narrow victory. He won 10 out of the 12 states where women could vote. But as Wilson prepared for his second term, women fighting for equal rights dominated the news. In Brooklyn, Margaret Sanger and her sister Ethel Byrne, also a nurse, had opened the first birth control clinic in the United States. Sanger argued that the vote was nothing compared to the importance of birth control, especially for poor women, a position that might have seemed to align with conservative eugenicists, but which did not, since they were opposed to feminism. Arrested for violating a New York penal code that prevented any discussion of contraception, Ethel Byrne was tried in January 1917. The story appeared on newspapers across the country. Her lawyer argued that the penal code was unconstitutional, insisting that it infringed on a woman's right to the pursuit of happiness. Byrne was found guilty on January 8th. In prison, she went on a hunger strike. 2 days later, Alice Paul and the National Woman's Party began a suffrage vigil outside the White House, carrying signs reading, Mr. President, how long must women wait for liberty? Public support for suffrage plummeted as the United States grew closer to entering the war, and questioning the president began to look like disloyalty. In January 1917, Wilson released an intercepted telegram from the German minister, Arthur Zimmermann, to the German ambassador in Mexico, in which Zimmermann asked Mexico to enter the war as Germany's ally, promising to help regain for Mexico the lost territories of New Mexico, Arizona, and Texas should the U.S. declare war on Germany. Days after Wilson was inaugurated, German U-boats sank 3 American ships. Wilson concluded that there was no longer any way to stay out of the war. At the beginning of April, he asked Congress to declare war. The world must be made safe for democracy, Wilson told Congress. Not everyone was persuaded. I want especially to say, Mr. President, that I am not voting for war in the name of democracy, Ohio's Warren G. Harding said on the Senate floor. It is my deliberate judgment that it is none of our business what type of government any nation on this earth may choose to have. I voted for war tonight for the maintenance of American rights. Congress declared war. But Wilson's claim that the United States was fighting to make the world safe for democracy was hard for many to swallow. Wilson had, in fact, pledged not to make the world democratic, or even to support the establishment of democratic institutions everywhere, but instead to establish the conditions of stability in which democracy was possible. A war for peace it was not. The war required a massive mobilization. All American men between 18 and 45 had to register for the draft. Nearly 5 million were called to serve. How were they to be persuaded of the war's cause? In a speech to new recruits, Wilson's new Secretary of State, Robert Lansing, ventured an explanation. Were every people on earth able to express their will, there would be no wars of aggression. And if there were no wars of aggression, then there would be no wars, and lasting peace would come to this earth, Lansing said, stringing one conditional clause after another. The only way that a lasting people can express their will is through democratic institutions, Lansing went on. Therefore, when the world is made safe for democracy, universal peace will be an accomplished fact. Wilson, the political scientist, tried to earn the support of the American people with an intricate theory of the relationship between democracy and peace. It didn't work. To recast his war message and shore up popular support, he established a propaganda department, the Committee on Public Information, headed by a baby-faced 41-year-old muckraker from Missouri named George Creel, best known for an exposé on child labor called Children in Bondage. Creel applied the methods of progressive-era muckraking to the work of whipping up a frenzy for fighting. His department employed hundreds of staff and thousands of volunteers, spreading pro-war messages by print, radio, and film. Social scientists called the effect produced by wartime propaganda herd psychology. The philosopher John Dewey called it the conscription of thought. The conscription of thought also threatened the freedom of speech. To suppress dissent, Congress passed a Sedition Act in 1918. Not since the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 had Congress so brazenly defied the First Amendment. Fewer than 24 people had been arrested under the 1798 Sedition Act. During the First World War, the Justice Department charged more than 2,000 Americans with sedition and convicted half of them. Appeals that went to the Supreme Court failed. Pacifists and feminists went to prison, and so especially did socialists. 96 of the convicted were members of the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, including its leader Bill Haywood, sentenced to 20 years in prison. Eugene Debs was sentenced to a 10-year term for delivering a speech in which he'd told his listeners that they were fit for something better than slavery and cannon fodder. Under this regime, W.E.B. Du Bois, the seemingly uncompromising leader and co-founder of the NAACP, was brought to heel. In 1915, in an Atlantic essay called The African Roots of War, Du Bois had located the origins of the conflict in European powers' colonial rivalries in Africa, indicting the global order itself. If we want real peace, Du Bois wrote, we must extend the democratic ideals to the yellow, brown, and black people. But after the United States entered the war, Creel called 31 black editors and publishers to a conference in Washington and warned them about Negro subversion. Du Bois wrote of revolution, more or less pledging not to complain about race relations for the duration, promising that the African American was not disposed to catalog in this tremendous crisis all his complaints and disabilities. He then wrote the first of many editorials for the crisis, making good on this promise. Let us, while this war lasts, forget our special grievances and close our ranks shoulder to shoulder with our white fellow citizens and allied nations that are fighting for democracy, he wrote in words that might as well have been written by Creel himself. Du Bois asked black men who could not vote in the United States to give their lives to make the world safe for democracy and asked black people to hold up fighting against lynching, whose numbers kept rising. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, Billie Holiday would later sing in a wrenching eulogy, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Walter Lippmann, writing in the New Republic, had argued for the United States to enter the war. Once it did, he signed up and was recruited to a secret intelligence organization called the Inquiry, whose objective was to imagine the terms of peace by redrawing the map of Europe. The Inquiry, needing a peerless stock of maps, took over the New York offices of the American Geographical Society. In that library, Lippmann, 28, drafted a report called The War Aims and Peace Terms It Suggests. Revised by Wilson, Lippmann's report became Wilson's 14 points, which the President submitted to a joint session of Congress on January 8, 1918, calling for a liberal peace that included free trade, freedom of the seas, arms reduction, the self-determination of colonized peoples, and a League of Nations. But the war had to be won before Wilson could begin to negotiate for that peace, and it had to be paid for. To that end, Wilson signed a tax bill, raising taxes on incomes, doubling a tax on corporate earnings, eliminating an exemption for dividend income, and introducing an estate tax and a tax on excess profits. Rates for the wealthiest Americans rose from 2% to 77%. But most people paid no tax at all. 80% of the revenue was drawn from the income of the wealthiest 1% of American families. Then, when taxes raised on income and businesses failed to cover the price of war, the federal government began selling war bonds. 22 million Americans heeded the call to buy liberty and victory bonds, leading to one unanticipated effect of the war. It introduced ordinary Americans to the experience of buying securities. The rhetoric of the war loan program advanced the idea of citizenship as a form of investment. One bulletin promised, "A financial interest in the government, large or small though it may be, helps to make better citizens." Wars, as ever, expanded the powers of the state. It realigned the relationship between the federal government and business, establishing new forms of cooperation, oversight, and regulation that amounted to erecting a welfare state for business owners. The National War Labor Board was charged with averting strikes so as not to impede munitions production, while the War Industries Board oversaw war-related manufacturing. The federal government managed the American economy with efficiency as its watchword. Industrial history proves that reasonable hours, fair working conditions, and a proper wage scale are essential to high production, one Army order advised. During the war, every attempt should be made to conserve in every way all our achievements in the way of social betterment. The government asserted new forms of authority over the bodies of citizens, too. A social purity movement campaigned against the spread of venereal disease, which became the subject of military ordinances. "You wouldn't use another fellow's toothbrush," one Army film pointed out. "Why use his whore?" And yet another moral campaign, prohibition, long a female crusade, also became part of the wartime expansion of the powers of the state. It was approved by Congress in December 1917 as a war measure. "No drunken man was ever efficient in civil or military life," said Tennessee Senator Kenneth McKellar. Outside of Congress, Americans were dubious. "A man would be better off without booze, but the same is true of pie," was the position taken by Clarence Darrow. Lippmann, meanwhile, went to Europe to begin to work toward Wilson's planned peace. Appointed to the London office of an inter-allied board for propaganda, Lippmann directed writings not at Americans, but at Germans and Austrians. Airplanes and unmanned balloons sent behind enemy lines dropped millions of copies of his leaflets. Like everything he wrote, they were as sticky as flypaper. One he wrote as if he were a German prisoner of war. "Do not worry about me. I am out of the war. I am well fed. The American army gives its prisoners the same rations it gives its own soldiers. Beef, white bread, potatoes, prunes, coffee, milk, butter." Copies were found in the rucksacks of a great many deserting German soldiers. Lippmann got to wondering, were minds so easily led? As the war drew to a close, the reckoning began. American losses were almost trivial compared to the staggering losses in European nations. Against America's 116,000 casualties, France lost 1.6 million lives, Britain 800,000, and Germany 1.8 million. Cities across Europe lay in ashes. America was untouched. Europe, composed of 17 countries before the war, had splintered into 26, all of them deeply in debt, and chiefly to Americans. Before the war, Americans owed $3.7 billion to foreigners. After the war, foreigners owed $12.6 billion to Americans. Even the terrifying influenza epidemic of 1918, which took 21 million lives worldwide, claimed the lives of only 675,000 Americans. The war left European economies in ruins, America's thriving. In the United States, steel production rose by a quarter between 1913 and 1920. Everywhere else, it fell by a third. The armistice came on November 11, 1918, when Germany agreed to terms of surrender tied to Wilson's 14 points, which the Allies had not themselves wholeheartedly endorsed. In an extraordinary departure from convention, Wilson decided to head the United States' 1,300-person delegation to the Paris Peace Conference in January 1919. This fell within his view of the scope of the presidency. Not everyone agreed. Many Americans objected to an American president leaving American soil. And whose interests was he meant to represent? "Mr. Wilson has no authority whatever to speak for the American people at this time," said Theodore Roosevelt. Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution stipulates that a president may negotiate a treaty, but ratification requires a two-thirds vote of the Senate. Notably, fatally, Wilson did not bring along with him to the conference even a single Republican senator. Wilson was at first met with outpourings of affection and hope. Crowds lined the streets of Paris to greet him as the God of Peace. This welcome did not do much to diminish his sense of mission. Lippman reported, the hotels were choked with delegations representing and pretending to represent and hoping to represent every group of people in the world. Wilson was especially eagerly received by delegates from stateless and colonized societies, Egyptians, Indians, Chinese, Koreans, Arabs, Jews, Armenians, Kurds. A young Ho Chi Minh, the future leader of North Vietnam, then living in Paris, presented world leaders at Versailles with a petition titled, The Demands of the Vietnamese People. All subject peoples are filled with hope by the prospect that an era of right and justice is opening to them. He tried to meet Wilson with no success. But Wilson left a lasting legacy. His rhetoric of self-determination contributed to a wave of popular protests in the Middle East and Asia, including a revolution in Egypt in 1919, made the nation-state the goal of stateless societies, and lies behind the emergence and force of anti-colonial nationalism. W.E.B. Du Bois made the journey to Paris 4 days after Wilson set sail, on a boat for members of the press. He was officially traveling on behalf of the NAACP and as a scholar aiming to gather material for a history of the war. But he was also there to attend a Pan-African Congress, which was held over 3 days at the Grand Hotel on the Boulevard des Capucines. And he may well have gone to Paris in an attempt to repair his reputation, gravely damaged by his having urged fellow black Americans to forget their grievances and make every sacrifice for the war. 30 black men were lynched in 1917, twice as many the next year, and in 1919, 76, including 10 veterans, some still wearing their uniforms, having fought, some people fought, the wrong war. In France, Wilson got much of what he wanted, but he did not get the peace he wanted, or the peace the world needed. Instead, the president fell ill in Paris, likely with the first in a series of strokes. Also, as the negotiations were on, his presence was much resented. Nearly every experienced critic seems to be of the opinion that he should have remained in America, H.G. Wells remarked. More bitterly resented was Wilson's wife Edith, who appeared to a devastated Europe to be visiting in the role of tourist. This may seem a trivial matter to note in a history of mankind, Wells allowed, but it was such small human things as this that threw a miasma of futility over the peace conference of 1919. The treaty makers, chiefly the United States, Britain, France, and Italy, redrew the map of Europe rather differently than it had been redrawn by Walter Lippmann in the offices of the American Geographical Society. They balkanized Europe by establishing new states, including Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, Poland, and Finland. And they punished Germany. The treaty shackled German industry. It deprived Germany of control over its own affairs. It demanded from Germany $32 billion in reparations. Looked at from above, below, and every side, I can't see anything in this treaty but endless trouble for Europe, Lippmann wrote. The New Republic, concluding that the League is not powerful enough to redeem the treaty, came out against it, a particularly difficult decision for Lippmann, who wrote the editorials condemning it. The magazine also serialized the publication of a shattering polemic called The Economic Consequences of the Peace by a young British economist named John Maynard Keynes. Keynes called Wilson a fool, a blind and deaf Don Quixote, and pointed out that the peace treaty merely continued the deprivation of wartime, warning that it would bring misery to Europe, the rapid depression of the standard of life of the European populations to a point which will mean actual starvation. Wilson believed that any shortcomings of the terms of the peace could be addressed by the establishment of the League of Nations, since any problem created by the treaty, he reasoned, could be solved by the League. Only the League, he thought, could make peace last. 2 days after returning to the United States, he delivered the Treaty of Versailles to the Senate and explained its provisions, including for the League of Nations, asking, "Dare we reject it and break the heart of the world?" In the Senate, what little support Wilson enjoyed came from fellow Democrats. Republicans proved implacable. The Republican chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Henry Cabot Lodge, had the 264-page treaty printed, announced that he would convene hearings on the subject, and then all but tabled the matter, stonewalling for 2 weeks while he had every word read aloud. Wilson, still ailing, decided to canvass the nation and left Washington on September 3, 1919, for a 17-state train tour. "I promised our soldiers when I asked them to take up arms that it was a war to end wars," he told his wife. "If I do not do all in my power to put the treaty into effect, I will be a slacker and never able to look these boys in the eye." In Nevada, his face began to twitch. In Utah, he sweated through his suit. By Wyoming, he was incoherent. Finally, in Colorado, on October 2, 1919, he stumbled while mounting the stage. "I seem to have gone to pieces," he said. He lost the use of his left side. For 5 months, he was hidden in the West Wing of the White House, unseen, even by his cabinet. Edith Wilson banned the public from the grounds. Even members of the Senate did not know the state of Wilson's condition. When the Senate sought compromise and the president proved unresponsive, the Senate could only conclude that he was uncompromising. In March of 1920, the Senate rejected the Treaty of Versailles and the League of Nations by 7 votes. The chance for a lasting peace came and silently went. 3. In 1922, when Walter Lippmann turned 32, he wrote a book called Public Opinion, in which he concluded that in a modern democracy, the masses, asked to make decisions about matters far removed from their direct knowledge, had been asked to do too much. Decisions in a modern state tend to be made by the interaction not of Congress and the executive, but of public opinion and the executive, he'd once observed. A mass democracy can't work, Lippmann argued, because the new tools of mass persuasion, especially mass advertising, meant that a tiny minority could very easily persuade the majority to believe whatever it wished them to believe. The best hope for mass democracy might have seemed to be in the scrupulously and unfailingly honest reporting of news. But this, Lippmann thought, was doomed to fall short because of the gap between facts and truth. Reporters chronicle events, offering facts, but they cannot govern society by episodes, incidents, and eruptions, he said. To govern, the people need truth, sense out of the whole. But people can't read enough in the morning paper or hear enough on the evening news to turn facts into truth when they're driven like dray horses all day. The solution Lippmann proposed to this problem was absurd, forged in the mind of a man who greeted the world with eyebrows arched. He suggested that the government open 10 bureaus of intelligence, one for each department represented in the cabinet, where expert intellectuals appointed for life, with sabbatical years set aside for advanced study and training, would put together all the facts and explain to the masses the truth. He eventually came around to seeing how silly that was, but what actually happened was a lot worse. By the end of the decade, managing public opinion would become a business in the form of public relations. Before then, women would gain the right to vote, the size of the electorate would double, and the problem would worsen. The 19th Amendment, ratified in August 1920, was the last constitutional act of the Progressive Era. It proved a checkered victory. Women achieved the right to vote only after the style of party politics had changed from the public popular politics of parades and marches and high voter turnout to the private domesticated politics of mass advertising and lower voter turnout. As one feminist pointed out as early as 1926, it is a misfortune for the women's movement that it has succeeded in securing political rights for women at the very period when political rights are worth less than they have been at any time since the 18th century. Attaining the right to vote also divided the women's movement between those who wanted to pursue equal rights and those who, realizing that equal rights would render obsolete an entire body of protective labor legislation, did not. So-called equalizers formed the Women's League for Equal Opportunity and the Equal Rights Association, sought passage of the Equal Rights Amendment first introduced into Congress in 1923, and viewed protectionism with cynicism and suspicion. Labor men wanted protective laws for women only so that they could steal women's jobs under cover of chivalry, one equalizer would write in 1929. Protectionists, meanwhile, formed the League of Women Voters. A half century later, as the Equal Rights Amendment at last neared ratification, this same divide among women would defeat it. In the 1920 presidential election, the Republican Warren G. Harding easily triumphed over the Democrat, Ohio governor and progressive reformer James Cox, and his relatively unknown running mate, the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, chosen in the main for his famous last name. Wilsonian idealism and internationalism was over, and so was an era of reform. Harding rode to the White House on a rising tide of conservatism, a reaction against progressive reforms that conservatives believed to be a betrayal of the nation's founding principles, and especially of the Constitution. "I must utter my belief in the divine inspiration of the Founding Fathers," Harding said in his inaugural address. He ordered the Librarian of Congress to take the original Constitution, the signed parchment, out of storage and erect for it a national shrine. He appointed as Solicitor General James Montgomery Beck, Mr. Constitution, a former corporate lawyer who'd written a series of immensely popular books explaining the Constitution. The Constitution is neither, on the one hand, a Gibraltar rock, which wholly rests in the ceaseless washing of time or circumstance, nor is it, on the other hand, a sandy beach, which is slowly destroyed by the erosion of the waves, Beck wrote. It is rather to be like